What's up, guys? Welcome to this being the first ever edition of our virtual Friday sessions. Now that I'm leaving Australia, I am doing these from all over the world together with the other three boys on the show. This one was really interesting. We covered a whole bunch of stuff from what's happening in the markets to, you know, the vulnerabilities of Australia and our dependence on the Australia-USA alliance with Chinese warships circling our coastlines, instability in the stock markets. Are we going to see a big real estate correction? There's lots of talk at the moment about Warren Buffett trying to offload his real estate business in the US and a whole bunch more. And at the end, we talked about one of James's acquisitions that he made a couple of years ago in the mobility space, aged care sector in Brisbane. We broke down exactly what he did to build that business, the mistakes he made, the things he learned, and why it's sometimes in life and in business, it's good to get out of a bad relationship, and how he's now moved on and is expanding into these new businesses that he's launching. It's a really, really cool discussion. So I think you'll find it really interesting. Mark had to come in by my mobile phone because he had some tech issues, but the sound is pretty good still. I think you're going to enjoy it, but make sure you drop a comment, let us know. The other thing we spoke about as well, by out of interest, was censorship in Australia and how we got censored last week and the impacts of that for us as a country and why it matters. With that said, like, subscribe. I hope you enjoy the pod. What's up, guys? Welcome to this, the first of our virtual sessions. This is the last day that I'm actually in Australia. I am wheels up tonight, headed out to Dubai and then on to Amsterdam and making the big move. So this is my last session from here, but I am joined, of course, here with Eric Machado, James Denham, and the one and only Mark Pola. How are you boys this morning?
Going good.
Yes. This is going to take a minute to get used to just not being in the studio. Guys, just so you know, you're in the hands of professionals. Look at us all shining. So there's a lot going on in this news cycle, guys. As always, at the top of the ticket, we've got the markets, of course. We've got Elon being fried out there in the world. We have some interesting stuff we wanted to dive into this week with James, and he's going to tell a little bit of a story. Want to unpack about one of his business recently, what he learned from that. But Mark, let's start with you because, I mean, there's a lot of people out there right now that are very nervous about the markets. We're seeing the stock market sort of on tenterhooks. We're seeing stories in the press of Warren Buffett, you know, rumored to be, you know, trying to offload his Berkshire Hathaway real estate business, which is a massive agency that they own. Mate, what is going on in the world? Do you think Donald Trump is currently crashing the markets, and if so, why?
Yeah, well, it's the old adage, you know. You've got to take him at his word, but not literally. And I think the thing that I'm noticing about this current administration, and that includes some of the adults in the room as well, like Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, and the other people that he has around him, is that they are being as transparent as possible about what they're trying to do. And in previous administrations, it was pretty clear that the stock market was a gauge of how well they were doing. And this administration is making it clear that the stock market is not going to be the gauge, that interest rates, getting interest rates down, is going to be the gauge of how well they're doing, because they think that we have an unbalanced economy. And we have had an unbalanced economy. It's been a financially driven market. 25% of GDP actually goes through the postcode of Washington. And there's a lot of imbalances in the system. I think they're trying to wash those out. And we spoke about this last week. I don't think it made it to the podcast, got chopped out. But the last 40 years, from like 1982 onwards, we've been in an interest rate downward cycle. And during COVID, something happened. Those interest rates got to zero. And that may have reversed now. And we spoke last week about how when that reverses, instead of the financial system and the economy being dominated by central banks, it shifts to fiscal impulse. And so the government now has a bigger say and a bigger influence in policy and things that are happening in the market. And I think the administration is telling us, hey, we don't care about a little bit of short-term volatility in the stock market. Long-term, it'll be fine, but we need to get those interest rates down in the short term so they can refinance debt.
Yeah, and that's the kicker, isn't it, Mark? So the US has about $7 trillion in debt coming due in the next 6 months. That's $7 trillion with a T, which is a massive, massive amount of money. I mean, I think we're running at nearly $1 trillion. Just the part they're refinancing is seven times the size of ours. And
Yeah, so
so
their total debt is something like 36 trillion.
yes.
During COVID, we're exactly 5 years anniversary since COVID, and they took out around 7 trillion of debt in that time, and that's all coming due now.
And the interest rates, obviously, today for that debt are significantly higher. So by crashing the stock market, guys, if you're trying to, and if you're wondering why are four Aussies who purport to be an entrepreneurial podcast or a wealth building podcast talking about US politics and US stock market, it's because this stuff affects the whole world. And so effectively, by crashing the US stock market, which is what's happening, investors seek safe havens. And those safe havens are, of course, US treasuries. And when the money rushes out of the stock market and looks for a safer place, there's more people bidding for those, which drives the yields down and the prices up for the treasuries, which makes it such that the US can refinance their debt at a
I
much
think that's
lower rate.
In
I
layman
think that's
terms, Mark, in layman terms, Mark, how does one crash a stock market if you were to
well,
answer
okay,
that in three
so
sentences?
yeah, that's a great point. I think Adam just made a really interesting point. I don't necessarily think, and there's a lot of people out there saying they're trying to kitchen sink the economy, they're trying to crash the stock market. To be clear, I don't believe any of that. I don't believe that they're trying to crash the stock market or trying to kitchen sink the economy, but they are trying to get the interest rates down. That is definitely a focus. And so, Adam, you hit the nail on the head. They are trying to get people to shift funds from stock market or from other investments into government bonds, 10-year government bonds, in order to bring so more demand for bonds, appreciating bond price, yields come down. We should probably clarify that as well, because it's a little bit counterintuitive. But when the yields come down, the people who are holding the bonds, their asset appreciates. And when the yields go up, if you're holding bonds, your asset depreciates. So I think they're trying to shift capital across to treasuries in order to get those yields down. They're not necessarily trying to crash the stock market, but because the stock market, the economy, and liquidity is all so finely intertwined, I think that's like part of the consequences of what they're trying to do, that there will be some volatility. Now, we don't know if it's going to be short term, medium term, long term, but there's going to be some volatility through this process.
But the instability, Mark, is being caused by mostly a lot of it is being driven by these tariff discussions, right? With Trumpy out there saying we're going to tariff, tariff, tariff. Is it that, you know, he truly believes in tariff? Because, you know, back in the day, America used to fund its whole country off tariffs. Like there was no income tax in America. And I think some people are saying, well, Trumpy is like from the old, like believes that that was a time in America where a lot of prosperous things happened. And, you know, do you think he's serious about that? Or do you think he's using tariffs to, you know, to create destabilization in the markets for the refinancing of debt? Do you have a view on
No,
that?
I definitely don't subscribe to the theory that he's trying to destabilize the markets. I think when people hear tariff-based headlines and when there's uncertainty in the markets, the markets become very headline-driven. But I don't think that's necessarily the goal. I think the number one goal for tariffs is to rebalance some of the imbalances that we spoke about earlier. A financialized economy, stock market driving everything. And to try and rebalance the trade deficits with our neighbors. Like, China has run a surplus, a $1 trillion surplus for years and years and years. What should happen when your country runs a surplus is your currency should appreciate, but it hasn't. It's been depreciating. And that's because of the financial engineering or the tricks that China's been playing. They've been taking that surplus money and they've been investing it into US assets, so treasuries, NASDAQ. And so their currency hasn't been appreciating. And I think what they're using tariffs for, the main lever that tariffs is good for, is to rebalance currencies and trying to.
How does this affect Australia, right? It's all good talking about US politics, but for the Aussies here that are in business, entrepreneurs thinking about getting into business, how do you see it affecting our economy? What's happening?
Well, we follow the US we largely follow the US economy on a lag. Everything is kind of intertwined. And so if the US is having interest rates come down, then we'll follow on a 6 to 12 to 18 month lag. And if the US has interest rates going up, then we'll probably follow on that lag as well. And so the cost of money is going to in is the how it happens in the US is going to affect how it goes in Australia as well. And some of the other trends are very similar too because of demographics. So there's a lot of talk at the moment in the US about how that boomer housing, so think, anywhere from 2.5 mil to $5 million prop family homes. People are wondering where that marginal buyer is going to come as these boomers start to sell the homes initially. So the first wave is going to be now, initially, as they start to put those homes on the market because they're downsizing out of them. And then when they start to pass on, there's going to be another wave of selling. But who's going to buy those houses? Right? And so that's a problem that I think we'll face in Australia as well. Unless we and we talk about this all the time, right? Immigration is such a hot button topic. But unless we keep the immigration spigots going in Australia, who's going to buy those big boomer homes here?
You wonder what percentage of the market is those big boom homes, though, Mark. Is it, I guess, not 50% of the market? Is it that significant that we're going to see a massive slump in that sector?
Well, the issue is these guys don't have any debt over these properties, right? So it's not like they have to hold on because they're underwater. They'll sell for whatever price they can so that they can live out the twilight of their lives, or that they can, or they pass, or the kids will basically, who have those properties have been passed on to, will just sell them at whatever price in order to realize that cash. So I do think it can have a pretty significant impact. Again, it might not have an impact on apartments, but that is going to have an impact because the boomer, James, the boomer population or the boomer cohort is the largest cohort in Australia, followed by the 30 to 40-year-old millennial cohort. But as we know, that they're struggling to be able to afford a deposit.
And Mark, it's not just the home though. I mean, a lot of these boomers own five, six investment properties as well,
That's
you know.
exactly the point. This is the first wave of selling that's probably going to start because you want to start downsizing your investment property portfolio.
They want to move into truly passive things that are perhaps more liquid and so on. So it is going to be interesting, you know.
And just the final link and why the stock market is so important. When the stock market is going up, everybody feels wealthy. The minute the stock market has a decline. So if we see a 30 or a 40% decline in the stock market, that is going to accelerate the wave of selling in these boomer properties, the second, third, the fourth home, because you'll be like, whoa, my share portfolio just went down by 40%. I need to sell some of these houses. So
And
it
my
can all
super.
cascade on itself.
And my super.
And my super, yeah.
Superannuation. Every Australian pretty much has money in super.
And I'm not trying to be alarmist or like Harry Dent call for a 40% decline or anything like that. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying this is the first time in 40 years where we are possibly facing a monetary shift. Instead of interest rates going down 40 years, they might be on their way up. And that has a whole bunch of cascading effects that I'm sure we'll continue to talk about on these Friday pods. But we need to be mindful, right? Going all in on property or going all in on the stock market at this point is probably not the right time in the cycle to be going all in on anything. We just have to keep aware here.
Yeah, we got a podcast with Larry Lepard coming out, I think, this week, who's based in Naples, Florida, 41 years in the finance game, you know, went through the tech boom in the 80s and 90s and proper player. And he talked about, you know, that they believe that there will be a fairly big drawdown in the stock market over the next little while, and it could be flat for 10 years, which is really quite an interesting prospect. Something a little bit closer to home, a headline I read this week, because I want to talk about Elon for a minute. You know, I have mixed feelings sometimes, but you know, he's obviously getting crucified at the moment. And I want to talk about that with his appearance on the Joe Rogan show, because I think that's a really interesting sort of canary in the coal mine. You know, just when you thought that, you know, the world was starting to get a bit more sane again, to see a guy like Elon, given what he's currently doing, it's just, to me, insane that anybody in America is crucifying the guy, right? Like, after, you know, he's bringing in all this efficiency and doing exactly what most people in Western countries have wanted for a long time: government accountability, all the scamming to stop, and the, you know, to see the guy getting crucified. But before we jump into that, One headline I saw this week, which got my attention, was Elon thinking that the US should leave the UN and NATO. Now, I'm not deeply read on this, but on as an Australian, that in particular gives me a little bit of nervousness, because if they are no longer part of that, and these these signals that we hear from Trump, where he's calling out Australian politicians and Turnbull and everything that he did this week, we've had a very cozy relationship. Australia is the only country in the world that's gone to every war with America since our inception. If we lose that coverage and that relationship with the US, when we've got Chinese warships circling the country for fun, Australia becomes a very juicy target without the protection of the United States. So that's a story that I think we all should be watching very, very keenly and making sure. That was one thing when I interviewed John Howard. He said that, it's very, very important that we maintain our relationship with the US, because Australia without the US is a very different proposition from a risk point of view.
There's so many angles that we can attack this from, right? Like if you look at, a lot of people think that Trump's being a wacko, but if you look at his rhetoric about making Canada a 51st state and about making Greenland part of America, the reason that he's doing these things is 100% geopolitical and from a military and a security point of view. Those shipping routes where Greenland is are some of the quickest and best and most effective shipping routes in the world, and that China's been trying to get in and amongst those shipping routes. Canada is such a resource heavy country that provides national security. Australia is in exactly the same boat as Canada. We are such an important resource rich country that if Trump starts talking about taking over Canada and taking over Denmark and we lose cover here in Australia, China, the natural response or the natural strategy for them would be to come and occupy Australia. Now, if you guys remember through COVID, a lot of people were making the claims that Dan Andrews and our politicians were Chinese puppets, right? That all the deals that these politicians are doing, especially in relation to energy, are so China friendly. So we're already on the way there, right? So losing protection from the US, I think, will significantly change how this country is run. If you think the socialist policies are getting bad now, they're only going to get worse and worse if we move more in that direction. So it's a significant risk, and I'm extremely worried about it too, Adam.
Yeah, this is where we need strong leadership, which seems to be just so lacking in the country. But it's just a story that we should keep an eye on, I think, as Australians. James, did you have something you want to say there?
No, I was just saying, we've only got, I suppose, America, half America is loving Trump being there, and he's only got 4 years in office, and potentially it might be a good thing for us if he only does have 4 years in office.
The other story I wanted to touch on quickly here was what happened to us last week with our release of the Senator Malcolm Roberts podcast. And I wanted to bring all of our listeners' attention to this and why this is an important story in and of its own right. So we interviewed Senator Malcolm Roberts. Like him or hate him, he is an elected sitting Australian senator in our parliament. We had Senator Roberts on the podcast. We interviewed him and he spoke freely on his thoughts on climate change. He spoke freely on his thoughts on COVID and a whole bunch of other stuff. That podcast went live, and on socials, it's done really, really well on Instagram. The clips are just pumping. But Google emailed us and demonetized the video, saying, we've reviewed this video and we are not going to promote this and allow ads to run on it. And I went out on my social media and said, censorship is alive and well in Australia. And some people said, well, how is demonetizing a video censorship? So let me just explain that quickly for the audience. If you're in the business of being a content creator, now we're self-funded, but most aren't, right? Most content creators who do this and put this much time, energy, and money into it are doing it so that they have to get a return. And part of that return, a big part of that return for a lot of them, is AdSense. So when you create a video that has 100,000 plays on YouTube, you get paid. All those ads that are fed into the video by YouTube, we get a percentage of the ad revenue. It's called AdSense, right? So when Google come along and say, that video that you just made, you can't make money on that video. That is akin to the trucker strike in Canada, Eric's home country, where the truckers did a peaceful protest, and which is their democratic right to do, and the government came in and froze their bank accounts. So they used money, they weaponized money to get them to do what they needed them to do, right? And as a content creator, when a platform like Google turns off your ability to make money, if you've got a family to feed, you've been told, don't produce content that we don't agree with. And if you do, there goes your livelihood. That is censorship at its finest. So if you ever wondered whether censorship is alive and well in Australia, yes, it is. And the reason that you need to care about it if you're an Australian is because this is our free speech. This is the ability to talk about real issues that people want to hear about. You've only got to look to the UK now and see that the UK has its whole identity as a country has been transformed, right? Like you see these, you see what's happening there. People are getting arrested in their own homes for making a comment on social media that people don't agree with. There are entire parts of the country that are unrecognizable. The number one baby names up there are Indian names now. It's nothing to criticize Indians. I'm not saying we're better or worse than Indian people. I love our Indian listeners and I love Indian people, but as a nation, we need to maintain our cultures. Otherwise, the world becomes a boring place. It's going to be dominated by the most populous countries, and we're not going to have the diversity. Like when I go to Japan, I love going to Japan because it's Japan. It's not westernized. And that's because they have unbelievably tight immigration policies in Japan. Like it's almost impossible to get a Japanese passport unless you're Japanese, right? They just don't do that. They don't, you know, many parts of Asia, they don't sell their land at all. So anyway, this is all, I wanted to raise this for the listeners. If you see a piece of content that is political in nature or is a bit controversial, we need you to share that content, because that video, I can tell you right now, that Malcolm Roberts video, in behind the scenes, all the metrics on the number of comments on YouTube, the engagement on YouTube, all the metrics, that video should be on its way to 100,000 views by now. And I think it's stuck at like not even 10,000 so far. It's being throttled, in my opinion, for sure. And we are living in a country where these big platforms are literally overriding our elected Senate officials, which is just disgusting. Do you guys have any comments on that? Now that I've had my rant.
I mean, I think this isn't anything new, right? Like this has been going on for a long time, and it makes it difficult for everyone to speak as much truth as possible, right? Because there is restrictions, and then with those restrictions, there's fear, right? Like what happens if you just keep talking about it? Do they just ban you off YouTube as an example? And like you said, it affects people's livelihoods. For us, we're not relying on that cash. You know, as we grow, obviously that will become larger and larger. But in the meantime, we're not having to rely on that. So it's okay. But for others, like you said, that, you know, they're content creators and this is, you know, their main source of income, those people got to be very, very careful, because at the end of the day, they need to pay their mortgage, they got to pay their rent, and they got to put the food on the table. And if they don't comply, they're going to be running into issues. And funny enough, my wife has been very, very outspoken, you know, throughout the entire, you know, COVID phase and all this stuff. And then I look at it now and half the stuff that she says, you know, people now believe. Meanwhile, she was looking, she was kind of like an outcast at the time, because we were all just indoctrinated into this thing, you know, to believe everything that was told to us. But I don't think it's anything new, but I agree with you, Adam, is what we got to do is just share the content as much as possible. We're very good at sharing, you know, comedic content, very, you know, funny content, silly content, but I don't think we're as good as sharing content that will actually change people's lives. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to change people's lives. We're not trying to, like, some people will listen to this podcast and get scared, right, about what's happening in the economy. Oh my God, the US, are they actually trying to, you know, smash the stock market? What's going to happen to the real estate market? You know, Mark mentioned you know, don't go all in on one thing, you know, all these types of things. And it kind of makes you, you know, that fear set in, and it makes you want to sit on your hands. And I've been noticing this a lot with people, friends, acquaintances, and even clients now, in a very scarce mindset, because there is a lot of uncertainty in the markets. And I think there's just a lot of uncertainty in people's lives. You know, are interest rates going to go up? Are they going to come back down? How much are they going to come down by? And there's an energy out there, right? And I put up, and the reason why I know this is I put up a post yesterday on my stories about this, and about being in an abundant mindset versus a scarcity mindset. When you're raised in an old school European family, all the energy is scarce, right? It's scarcity. They were born poor. They immigrated into, you know, Australia as an example, or Canada, with not a lot of money. So that scarce mentality is very, very strong. And I get scarce mentalities from time to time as well. But with me now, I can notice it. I can notice it in the dialogue. I can notice it in the energy. And I think for people, they need to just be a little bit more aware on what their inner dialogue is talking, right? And for me, what really helps me is giving. And when I say giving, it doesn't mean you have to give, you know, from a monetary perspective, but just helping others. And over the weekend, within like a 1 hour period, I introduced 4 different people together. And for me, that fills my bucket, because I know something will come from that for them. And I'm not doing it for a kickback or a commission. It actually fills my bucket, because I know I'm making that change. I'm making that difference. And I think everyone has to find what that is for them to get them out of this scarce mindset. And it might be education, and what you don't know is scary, right? Like if you're driving in a car with no navigation and you're going through a whiteout, that's scary. But as if you have the navigation on and you know where you're going, it's a little bit different. You're educating yourself on what routes to take. And I think a lot of people are just going with a horse with blinders with no navigation on in life. And I think they, once they become a little bit more clear on that as well, and a little bit more generous with their time, I think that scarce mentality will turn into more abundance.
Eric, I've got a story that I can share that kind of backs that theme up as well. Like I had a call with someone during the week, and we were just basically talking about portfolio, like wealth allocation, and how to kind of what they should be doing, whether they should be selling their own home, how they should structure their investments in this world moving forward. And this person had 2 commercial properties, a very, very nice home, a business. And you know, let's call it that their net wealth was like 3 or 4 million, right? And we started the conversation from that exact scarcity mentality place. It's like, you know, I feel like my interest rates payments are quite high. We might be moving into a world with rising interest rates, property prices, and all. He's like, I'm fearful that. And I said, well, I said, let's just stop for 1 minute. I said, first, all the things that you're fearful of that are worth considering and are 100% true, and let's acknowledge them. But let's begin this conversation from a different place. The reality is, with your net worth, it puts you in the top 1% of net worth individuals in the entire world. So you have a Tats Lotto ticket that 99% of the population doesn't have. How about we start the conversation from that point of view, and how we're going to make decisions to cash in on that Tats Lotto ticket that you currently have? And I think, you know, a lot of people listening to this show are in Australia, and yes, things are getting harder and the cost of living. I bought a box of veggies yesterday, it was $191, and I post about that and complain about that and things like that. But if we're starting this journey from the comfort of these Australian shores, I think that does put us in that lucky sperm club to some extent. And we should start by framing the situation from that viewpoint, I think, to begin with, and it's going to make us more productive in looking for solutions. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think for people's mental health, that's very, very good advice, is starting in that place. And also, you know, taking a longer view as well. Like, you know, everybody who's, if you're trying to sort of time any market, whether it's real estate, whether it's stocks, whether it's crypto. The key to all of this is deep education and time. All of these things change. Like real estate is going to go up and down. Crypto is going to go up and down. And the market's going to go up and down. Of those three, the only one that you don't see the down is real estate. You don't feel it until it's you trying to sell your house and you're getting offers below what you'd hoped. But any other time, you don't see or feel it, so it's a bit more stable. But if you take a long-term view, I think with a lot of these things, we're in a world where, you know, at least for now, they're going to keep printing money, and that money basically is going to find its way into the asset markets, whether it's the equities, as in the stock market, or real estate, or crypto. So most of these things are going to go up in time, with a few exceptions. You know, like if you see fundamental shifts, like in commercial real estate, you know, it's struggling to, the office sector is struggling to recover. That whole sector is having to be repurposed because of technology, right? There was a building recently sold in, I think it was Chicago, for like, it's a high-rise building of like, I can't remember exactly, but it's like 30 floors, and it was sold for the price of the steel in it. I think it was like $3 million for a 30-floor building, because you're not going to put offices back in there, right? And the cost of turning it into resi. So unless there's like really groundbreaking shifts in the use of these things, you know, a lot of them are these financial markets or tools, should I say, sectors are going to inflate over time. And you've just got to do your due diligence and be patient on which ones you're going to.
And the thing with that is there's always risk in anything that you invest in, no matter how much research, no matter how educated you are, no matter how much conviction you have towards something. Like that person that sold that building for $3 million, a 30-story tower for $3 million, right, at some point would have paid a lot more money for that. And prior to COVID, I bet the vacancy was half decent and he was getting paid rent, or she was getting paid rent, and then COVID happened. And that's one of the things that people don't see coming, right? None of us seeing COVID happening. Like when we had our luxury holiday accommodation business at that time, I'm like, this is a solid, solid business. The only thing that can take this out is a natural disaster, right? Like a massive cyclone or a hurricane or something that wipes out, you know, the Gold Coast for a period of time. And then all of a sudden this flu came out and stopped the world. And I was just like, oh my God, like this business is going to be in for a real, real impact. And it did for a period of time. But sometimes you don't see, we all have blind spots and we don't see them, no matter how good you are at picking things. So where I'm going at here is, again, it's just becoming as educated as possible as you can in multiple markets, right? Sometimes you need to know something very, very deeply in one market, like what you are at the moment, Mark, right? With trading as an example, and I am with real estate. But you still have to be kind of a jack of all trades at some point when you're looking at the big spectrum of the economy and understand what's happening and what are the levers that affect these types of things, like interest rates, as an example. So that's my...
I just quickly Googled that for the listeners' interest. It's it was in St. Louis. You can see it here on the camera.
Yep.
It's a 44-story building built in 1986. It sold for $3.6 million, less than 2% of its peak price.
That's incredible.
98% off its peak price, because it just cannot be used, which is really...
But I wonder what happens is COVID, like for instance, if COVID doesn't happen, right, how does it affect that versus, because there's COVID, but there's also not just COVID, technology, right?
Well, like the big thing is AI, Eric. AI is going to create similar sweeping shifts. And I would love to just say to everybody, don't be afraid of anything. But I think with AI, I think we do need to be very, very awake to the fact that we actually do live in a time where we are going to see the reshaping over the next decade of entire industries. So now is a time to lean into education and to get into a mastermind where you can sit and talk about what opportunities are out there. Like yesterday I met with, I got a text on Saturday from my patent attorney in the US, Eric. And Eric said, I'm on the Gold Coast in Surfers Paradise, I'm gonna catch up. So we went down to Hotshots in Main Beach. And I said, what have you been working on? He said, I've built an AI, which I'm going to be taking to the largest patent attorney patent firms in the United States. And he's been writing patents for 25 years. And he said, I've trained this AI to do 80% of the heavy lifting. And I'm going to be, I reckon I can probably get $700 US per patent application. And that will save the law firms hundreds of millions of dollars a year from using my AI, and they'll happily pay it for what it'll save. And it's designed by patents. And so there's this reshaping that's going to happen out there to the, to, like I showed that office tower, because that's just a physical expression of the redefining of an entire financial asset. We're going to see the redefining of entire industries as a result of AI over the next 5 years, 10 years at the longest.
Yeah, 100%. And I don't think I fear. Sorry, James, I know you had a point. I'll throw it to you next. I know, like, we talk about fear and mindset and things like that, but fear is healthy. Like, we should be fearful about the changes that are about to rip through the economy and the way that we live. We should be fearful. That's healthy. What we should be working on, though, is becoming anti-fragile, so that no one change or no one point of failure could wipe us out. The goal should be to fear what's coming and prepare for it and become anti-fragile. And that means whether that means having a diverse portfolio, whether that means having more businesses, whether that means passive cash flow, but having the goal to become more anti-fragile, I think should be a goal that everyone seeks in this changing time.
It's that time of year again at Unemployable, where we're opening up our Unemployable business coaching program. It's over a 12-month period, and with that, you get private one-on-one coaching, group coaching, as well as private and live events throughout the year. You could get private coaching with me, and not only me, but our panel of experts that we have put together. These panel of experts have been in our network and are the exact people that we use in our business successes. People from branding, sales, marketing, our lawyers, our accountants, everyone that has helped build our businesses, you have access to. If this sounds of interest, go to www.unemployable.com.au/coaching and register your interest to see if it's a fit for you and us. Hope to see you there.
You know, just a short comment. I'm watching a podcast last night. It was about a 3-hour pod, somewhere halfway through it, with a guy named Ty Lopez. Like him or not, I had a newfound respect for him, and going back and listening to his story and where he's at currently, and just hearing the decimation of majority of industries from AI was mind blowing.
It's going to be huge.
Accounting, we won't even require an accountant at all. Full stop. Moving forward. In the coming years, this is his prediction anyway. Legal, accounting, unless you're in the top 5 to 10%, then you'll be a boffin in that. But the rest of them, forget it, you're gone. So,
and it's little things, right? Like one of our other businesses that we have, we need to write a contract with a bunch of terms and conditions. Usually, you would hire a lawyer, and probably $4,000 to $5,000 you'd pay for them to get something like that done. And I ended up just doing it myself. Through ChatGPT, and let me tell you, and that's very basic AI, right? But that's a perfect example of $4,000 or $5,000 that wasn't given right to an external company that was saved in house. Yes, it was a little bit of time, but probably maybe 4 to 6 hours of time is what it really took. And I'm not an expert at ChatGPT. I'm not an expert at the inputs. But I'm learning as I go, just like everybody else. But let me tell you, if it was someone like James, who's a lot more advanced than it and uses it a lot more, he could have probably got it done in half the amount of time. So the efficiency is just going to get better and better and better.
And very shortly, you'll have AIs that are Australian-specific law, commercial law, maybe contract law, or whatever, that will be as watertight as the lawyer down the road. But then you can probably see them now in the meantime when you go to a lawyer with here's my document, can you check it? They'll say, no, it needs to be written from scratch, and they'll give you all the bullshit that comes with it. That's all fucking complete lie, because it's written better than they could probably write it, but they're going to end up, I need to start from the beginning. Very shortly, you'll start to see some of these contracts getting contested in court and winning or holding water as well. And then at that point, that tsunami or that rush away from using human labor or workforce will be completely gone.
And what happens when those workforces start to disappear, right? Like, let's link it all back. So at the moment, property prices in Washington, D.C. are down like 25 to 30% because everyone's getting fired and they're all trying to move out of Washington, sell their houses and move out. So if you've got a financial hub like Sydney or a city that's rich in lawyers and consultants, all of a sudden, if AI starts replacing those people's jobs, everyone's going to start trying to exit those cities and sell their properties, which again is going to put downward pressure on
just
on
think about areas. What,
unless the robots need homes.
Just think about what Mark said there, guys. Don't miss what he said. That has happened since Elon has come in with Doge. 20% reduction in the average home price in Washington, D.C. in 3 months. Imagine if that happened in Australia, 20% reduction, right? Imagine what would happen with banks, the LVRs. The impact would be enormous if that happened here. But James, just what you were saying there, just on the legal side, there's a lot of discussion that I've been listening to online about whether you said, oh, you know, these contracts will be tried in court. Well, that's if there are courts. There actually is discussion that the entire court system will be replaced by AI because there's no need. With all the case law can be fed into an AI, all the facts can be fed into the AI, and a settlement can be said, this is it. We've studied 5,000 of these cases. This is where these things settle. If both, you can go through the court system if you want to. You can settle it right here and now, but this is what 5,000,
and you know, you'll so probably get eliminate the biases with different judges as well, and all that, magistrates and that as well, because you'll have a standardized outcome for said crime or whatever.
It's totally proven that, you know, like there's a whole bunch of stuff like, you know, they've proven now that something like 40 or 50% of what we recall in our past, I can't remember what the study was, but it's not even factual. And when it goes back 20 years, like, it's not even close to factual. The way we remember things as human beings, as time passes, we tell stories and we get involved in narratives, but it's not factual. And the further it goes back, like a 20-year-old witness is actually useless. If you get a judge, if you're going into a court for a crime, you're much better off going in first thing in the morning when the judge has just had a cup of coffee and is fresh than at 3 in the afternoon when he's been abused all day and had people all day say, get this guy out, 20 years. You know, like, there is massive bias in the legal system. Another example of this, like I'm studying now all the time, looking for alternatives to spice up my returns, right? And I watched a video from an influencer that I follow pretty closely online. And he said, look, I don't normally talk about this stuff, but for the last 3 years, I've been testing a trading bot, right? I showed it to you guys in the Facebook group, in our chat group. He said, I've been doing it for 3 years. It's this trading bot basically trades Bitcoin. And just calls or puts, I can't remember, I'm just going through it right now. But over 3 years, it has not had any losses except one very, very small loss because there was a disconnect in the API or something. But it's returned 43% return just trading a bot. Now, the people who invented this, when I've gone ahead and opened up the Bybit account and going through the thing, at the end of the month, they say, here's how much money you made. You have to submit to us our commission, which is 30% of the trading profits they're taking. But at 43% net return, you can imagine how many people are using these trading bots to do it. Now, I'm going to try it just with a small amount of money and see if it's real. But it just shows you what people, I suspect probably young people, have created this trading bot. Imagine how much money they would possibly have traded on a bot like that. That's using, and that probably started before AI was as big as it is now, that the opportunities for these people that are across this stuff to just arbitrage the price of law, the price of trading systems and all that. There's so much money to be made.
43% a month?
No, 3% a month, 43%. Yeah,
and that's 43%. If it was 43% a month, I wouldn't be here and be like, bye.
But that's 3% a month, not counting Mark. That's not counting the increase, because the guy that I'm following that's doing this, he's getting it all in Bitcoin. So he said, if I actually count the appreciation of the Bitcoin price over time, it's something like 150% annually when you compound in the return of the Bitcoin growth.
That's wild. My finance broker, who used to be like a financial planner and he understands trading and technicals, messaged me the other day and he said, I'm building a trading bot. It's going to cost 10 grand. Do you want to go halves in it? And obviously you get to use it for free. And I'm like, that's interesting. But I've always kind of been, maybe it's my control nature or whatever, but it's worth looking at, right? Like,
dude,
all these different things.
He showed 3 years trading history of month by month by month. He said, this is not bullshit. And I follow this guy. He's not like a scammy, sleazy dude. He basically sold his house in 2017 and he put all of his money into Bitcoin 2017. And the world media beat a path to his door going, this crazy Dutchman has just sold his house and put it all into Bitcoin. And I think it was about $4,000 a coin at the time. And now he's a multi-millionaire. He lives with his family in Thailand, travels the world and loves EDM and dancing and partying. But he said, look, I'm a Bitcoin holder, but I've been doing this as well on the side to acquire more Bitcoin. And I just watched the video. I'm like, dude, this is a three-year trading history of a no-loss 43% return. I'm just like, holy shit.
On a live account.
Yeah, on a live account, completely automated bot. And all you do is you open a Bybit account, you plug the bot in, and then they never ask for – you're in control of your funds the whole time. At the end of the month, they send you an invoice for the gains. And if you don't pay it, they just cut you off from access to the bot.
I know that there's a lot of people that probably watch this podcast and they're sitting in a job or they're even running their own business thinking to themselves, is this what I want to be doing moving forward? And every time we mention an idea like this, this is not an endorsement to go out and do that specific idea that we're talking about. But I guess what we're trying to show in live real time is this is how the four of us are also influenced by what we should do next. We have these conversations, we listen to what other people are trying or doing, and we see what kind of fits in with our temperament, with our personality, with our kind of objective and goals. And, you know, we've talked about so many different things over the years and, you know, 90% of them we've just ignored or let go by, but there's 10% of the things that we discuss that we go out and we actually try and they become significant money makers for us. So, you know, that's part of the journey.
It is. And I'll share once I've actually done it and got real results, I'll share it with people here. You know, I don't get anything from it, but I do it because it's just intellectually interesting. And you can start with like $5,000. So you don't have big money involved. So it's always very interesting. You got to be open to these things and be willing to try without shiny object syndrome, of course, but just being open to learning more.
100%.
Mm.
All right. So what else? Anything else we want to finish up on before we wind this one up, guys? Anybody got anything?
I wouldn't mind, James, into your existing business that you had prior, just a few learnings, I think, would be good. Because
yeah, sure.
I think what happens is when you're involved in a business and you don't think it's as important, right? Because it's just you're in it all the time. Whereas when you tell the story and externally, I'm very intrigued by the story, and I know so is, you know, Adam and Mark. So it'd be good just to kind of unpack that a little bit, maybe for 5-10 minutes.
Yeah, sure.
Let's give us a high level, James, of it first, so we just understand the business.
Yeah, what we did, we acquired a what they call assistive technology or mobility company. I can't remember when it was, February 2023, if I can't remember what it was. Going in there, so we did a lot of things right, and the thesis or the overall thinking was right. It was just the sales process when we really got under the hood that didn't quite suit the business that I want to be involved in. And we touched on this last week, Eric. I think it was last week when we talked about, you know, if you get it's the same amount of work, choose the business wisely. And I made this comment last week about, you know, Homozy, obviously, Alex Homozy, for those who don't know who he is, Google him, is the hottest property around at the moment when it comes to marketing and sales. Is that more often than not, you don't realize the business you're in until you're in it. And this couldn't be more true in this situation. So we acquired when you say mobility, scooters, aged care. So we're thinking we've got a retiring population, the boomers, which is true. So there's all these ticks down the checklist. Mobility is going to be a large piece of that. I think 1 in 2 people over 65 need a mobility product of some description. So that a lot of and government funding behind that, you've an NDIS, so that takes that the financial concern out of it. So there's a lot of, as I went through the checklist, I went, right, oh, look, the kaleidoscope started to become quite clear. Then we zeroed in and created a list of mobility companies in Australia, every single one of them actually, and then started an outreach campaign. So what we call M&A or mergers and acquisitions. So, I won't dig into that too much right now because that's another whole probably an hour in itself. It's a secret sauce to getting that right. So we had all those things, ducks lined up. We bought a mobility company on the north side of Brisbane, and we could see it needed a rehabbing from a digital rehab, like a new website. Lead generation was run really poorly. There's a whole lot of raft of things that could, we could improve upon. So as we got in there, I rebuilt the front end marketing model. So for those of you not in the marketing game, we built what we call a funnel. So that was a landing page, in other words, a mini website where when you run paid traffic from Facebook or Google, they click on an ad and take them to a page where they have one action to fulfill, one action only. And that was an assessment. What I did in that scenario there is I created, I think it was about 8 or 9 question assessment. Basically, like when you go to a doctor, you sit down and he goes, well, what's the problem? And he talks you through and asks a series of questions to work out what the prescription is going to be to solve the problem. So I thought, well, when I jumped on the phone, I had some guys on the phone. I thought, well, let me just structure a sales framework, if you will, to work out what the needs were of the person, so we could then give them the correct product. So off that landing page where they click, they go through, I created more of a curiosity-based landing page. It's which mobility scooter suits your needs best. Take the 2-minute quiz and find out now. So it's curiosity-based, and it's very like a selfish offer. In other words, the person, when I say selfish, it's a lot of self-interest in there because they're going to work out what product they actually need. In short, they're going through and they get a result at the end, but what that gives us is a hell of a very, very rich lead, information-rich lead. Which gives them let me try and get this right in the sense of without offending anyone, the people we're talking to aren't exactly out there in the workforce. They're at home, they're semi-incapacitated, so the propensity for them to take a phone call from us after they've just done an assessment was high. So again, another tick. So we've got great high quality information rich leads at a fantastic conversion rate. And then the call rate, in other words, when we put an appointment setter on to then book an appointment with one of our specialists, the connect rate was really high because they're at home. They have a proper need, not a want. In other words, we're selling a painkiller here, not a vitamin. There's a big learning in that as well, is that in life, generally, people can go without their vitamins, but if they've got a headache, that painkiller's getting got. They're definitely going to go and buy it. So we're going through this tick list. It was going, yep, we're getting all this really right. I'll get to where it sort of the bottleneck came into it in a minute. So so the call rates, in other words, connection rate was high. They'd then book an appointment with one of our specialists. We trained up all the product specialists on the products. And from there, this is where the bottleneck sort of got in the way. In a sense, that you had two types of customers. One was government funded, and one was, in other words, NDIS or My Age Care, which for more the people over 65. And then you had the self-funded. And self-funded was fine because what I wanted to build was what I've always built is a remote sales team. In other words, lead generation, remote sales team, convert, have a phone call, solve the problem, deliver the product, usually in the info space, and this time was with our physical product. So that was all good and well, but where it came into it, a few of the issues is that when you've got government funding or government-funded programs is that what the customer often needed was a sign off from an occupational therapist. And to do that, the occupational therapist in the old school wanted to see the person with sitting in the actual product or using the actual product physically. So that created the bottleneck where I went, I don't particularly want to go and put, warehousing in, Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, Perth, every other major center in Australia. So I was like, okay, well, how do we get around this? Is that we then worked out that we could get certain occupational therapists would sign off on our products if they saw them once or twice, depending on the product. So what I then did is went, right, okay, well, how do we do this virtually? So we set up a studio in the warehouse in Brisbane, and we had a demonstrator, if you will, a specialist go through that product and demonstrate the product live on a Zoom call. with the occupational therapist and the client. So, and that seemed to work quite well. But and we also had a committee presentation at the start, which was based on the information that I got from that assessment to begin with. So effectively, when we're jumping on the call to start with, it was rehashing their current problems, pains, and all the stuff that they filled out on that assessment on the way through, which evoked that emotion again to get them into buying mindset. And especially when you've got an occupational therapist there, it certainly gave an air of professionalism that we actually gave a shit about the customer, listened to what their needs were, and were, you know, prescribing the correct product. So that's where it sort of started to fall down for us, or for me anyway, in the fact that if we were to grow this business, it was going to be take a hell of a lot more capital and a lot of more manpower to put some warehousing or showroom around the country. So for that, it was started to go, right, all right, this is not really, it's a boots on the ground model, we'll call it. And that's where it started for me to go, I can do the whole front end, the marketing piece, right up to the point of sale. And that's where I went, you know, let's really rethink this. And so with that in mind, for the people that, and also Zoom was an issue for the elderly, and getting them on a Zoom call with the OT and lighting all those people up, then having someone doing a product presentation. So there's so many people in the sales process as well. You've got an appointment setter, you've got a specialist, trained up specialist is effectively a remote closer or a phone salesperson. Then you have just someone doing a product demonstration, and then it's like herding cats in the end. And I just said, look, let's just sell through this stock and get rid of it. It was not the business that I wanted to be involved in. And then you look at in the marketplace, when I started looking into this sector, there was two or three of the larger players who do have quite a large network of warehouses or showroom space. We're getting funded from specifically from a Riverview Capital out of New York. So private equity coming in, and they were dumping like a few hundred million bucks into this sector. So I saw what they were seeing. It's just that I didn't particularly have 100 million bucks to go and start swooping up and acquiring all these smaller mum and pop show mobility companies. And that's what that's how this sector had formerly been run, was the mum and pop baby boomers. So again, another tick. I was looking for motivated sellers, baby boomers looking to retire. The kids don't want to run a mobility company, not sexy. They want to be YouTubers. And exactly this, what happened in our scenario, the parents, or the owners, children, had all worked in the business. They didn't want to be involved in it anymore. They'd moved on, and they were just like, we need to get rid of this thing. And so, we bought well, and everything else was fantastic. It was just that actual type of business model lends itself to having a lot of boots on the ground and a lot of overhead, and that was just not the business I wanted to be involved in. So
James, in hindsight, thank you for sharing all that, because first of all, it's very hard to share lessons in retrospect, right? Oh. And especially when you've gone, okay, we misjudged that market and you moved on from it, you sold through the stock and moved on. Unfortunately, because you bought well and you bought it with a heap of stock, you came out of it fine. So thank you for doing that. But when you look back, and I know this because I've done exactly the same thing, you look back and you go, shit, why didn't I just stop and really slow down and think about that single question? How does the money, or what has to happen for the money to go from the consumer's bank account or the government's bank account, in your case with NDIS, and into your bank account? When you really dissect all of that and you go, okay, I have to orchestrate the synonymous meeting of an OT, a client, a salesperson at Zoom, and you look at all the little complexities, and like you, and you got to have a sort of like a photo of Cheryl from, you know, outer suburbs of Brisbane, who's in a mobility scooter, or, you know, that she wants to replace, and she's an old person, and you have a photo of her there, and you think, what's it going to take to make all this work for Cheryl? When you really, really think through it, you know, in a lot of cases, if we were patient and really thoughtful and with the right advice around us or friends around us, we could discover these things in advance, right? But we don't, because we're optimistic entrepreneurs. Is that kind of how you would describe it?
That's for sure. And the previous owner, they did have warehousing in WA, Melbourne, Sydney, Townsville, and Brisbane. And, you know, had we just focused on Brisbane only, that wouldn't have been an issue, because that was the model. You had a van, you had a guy going in a van doing a demo and whatnot. But the way I again, back to Eric's point last week about, you know, which business do you really want to be involved in and the same amount of effort. I thought if we just want to be Brisbane specialists, how many leads can I generate online? Because I ran this exercise. I was doing geolocated Brisbane, drop the pin in the center of Brisbane, 100K, obviously 100K to the water, but 100K radius. How many leads can you generate? And what are the cost per leads to generate those? And I thought, okay, it's not really enough to build a business that I want to be involved in. I don't particularly enjoy business where I've got to have a BDM going knocking doors on, you know, on OTs, like all that just sounds like hard work to me. If I can't Dan Turner, who pulls all the levers for MX, that was on the pod some time ago, and he said, if you can't generate leads on demand online, it's not really the business that you want to be involved in. And I echo his same sentiment. It was just not the business I want to be involved in. I could think of nothing worse than sitting there knocking and getting through all the red tape and doing deals with, you know, aged care providers, and just not the business I want to be involved in. So go ahead, Mark.
No, I was just going to, just a quick one. It raises a really interesting point, and you mentioned Dan from MX, and it reminds me of MX Store, right? Like MX Store, Eric, has had so much success because you guys are so brilliant at the online and e-commerce part of the equation. But the reality is that there's only one MX Store in Australia, and that's because you invested all that capital into the logistics side of the business. That is where all the capital really was required initially and over the years.
If you look at MX in that, from that context, if they take the online part out, it was a bit like a walk-in sort of store.
That's why our business model is in that, right? Like our competition, their business model, our main competitor, their business model is that they've got shops all around the country, right? And I'm sure some of those shops do half decent, but that's just not the business model that we want to go down. But what I want to say to James is, you know, like, it takes a lot of heart to sit there and realize, you know, I'm actually building a business that I don't want. A lot of people will be building businesses that they don't want and continue to build the business that they don't want and show up every week because they don't want, like, you know, I teach my kids all the time, never give up, keep trying. But there's a point in time where you got to look yourself in the mirror and go, you know what, I actually don't want to be doing this for the rest of my life, for the next 5-10 years. And sometimes, like you say, James, you just got to put a bullet in it. And I know you did it in a very ethical way as well, which a lot of people don't do. And now it gives you the time, right, and the space to go and pursue other things, which you're already doing. And some of those businesses are, you know, unreal ideas. So I just want to take my hat off to you for actually accepting that, number one, and being vulnerable and talking about it, because this is lessons from someone that has years and years and years of business experience. And we all get it wrong from time to time. It's not that we know every answer. We're learning in real time, like anyone else that's listening to this. And we're in the trenches as well, just like you guys.
Yeah. And another piece to add to that as well, you know, as I said, if you go through the checklist, there wasn't many things that I missed that didn't have a bone, like there were, you know, a tick. But then you go to the point of going, okay, well, this sector as well, trying to recruit sales staff to listen to people that are 65 to 85 that are fucking at home in dire straits, and, you know, it's not the most uplifting sales environment to be involved in either. And to try and you've got to find a very special person who's super compassionate and cares deeply about, not saying we don't get it, most people don't care deeply about the elderly, but who really has the compassionate part to them, that also that are trainable, that can sell. So, because ultimately nothing, regardless whether you love Betty or not, the doors don't open unless the sale takes place. So recruitment was also, quite a tricky one as well. So
yeah, I like to... think about how much patience you need for your own parents, right? Let alone complete strangers.
It's like providing tech support to seniors. That would be so hard to keep. Mate, people.
it was, and then don't forget, off the back of that, you've got a spare part. Then you got a, because we were exclusive distributor for we were the wholesaler for a product. So there was another tick. We had a moat around the business as well. So on one side of the ledger, there's so many things going for this business that we had. And then the other side of the ledger was, unless you're going to get funded properly, and then go and put a boots on the ground model. And I would even dare say that these guys that did get funded out of the US, both of them have been acquired and by private equity out of the US, because the US sees this coming as well. As I would argue, they're probably running in the red. They wouldn't be making it. They're at the moment, they're in acquisition phase. They're putting the nets out and they're scooping up every mum and pop show. And it'll be we've talked about this before, monopoly or a duopoly anyway. Is there's going to be two main competitors that control this space in the country. And
they don't always end in champagne though, James. You know, a lot of times they end in tears. There was all those consolidators came into the Amazon space buying up Amazon companies. They've all ended in tears. It happens all the time. James, you know, I like to think about these businesses. Sometimes I think about them all as relationships, and sometimes you're in a bad marriage and it's best to call it and move on and start dating some hotties.
Yeah, well, you know, could agree with you more, Adam.
Great advice.
But also that it gives you, you know, when you sit down with the pad and paper and a glass of wine and you put down the middle of the bit of paper, it's like, what was good about it? What was bad about it? What would you do again? What wouldn't you do again? You come up with that. Okay, now, as Eric alluded to, I've got a couple of other companies that are we're literally kicking over, or one of them has, but I'll give it a refresh, and it's about to start pumping leads again this week. I got another company who are in the early stages of going through this whole process, landing page, curiosity assessment, and all that. And you guys know what that business is, and we'll kick that into gear as well. It certainly makes you put a proper lens on what it is I want to generate leads for, and what the sales processes look like. And one of them is a physical product-based business, and one of them is an info-based business. So I've always sold info and one physical product, and the physical products-based business, we're doing it a lot differently, and we're doing it at a full pre-order. It's a fairly premium price product, where they sort of start about 10 to 15 grand and go north, and we're going to run that on a pre-order model. I've already proved that up myself last year, and so we're just going to be instead of kicking the leads in the gear for that this week with the sales team, and the other one is our info business. Selling info is a lot easier if you've got the right right niche in that high ticket space, just purely for the fact of deliverability, and you don't have to worry about inventory and ordering and tariffs and all that sort of.
A better way to maybe describe that is a data business. We're not going to disclose it now, but it's sort of like a data info as opposed to wealth creation type info, right?
Yeah, yeah. Look at 100%.
The data service.
Yeah, exactly that. So, as soon as we send it live and get some results, I'll reveal all there. But, exactly that. It's a bizarre, but we're supplying all the leads for the people for the business opportunity, and they take the lion's share of the sale commission that gets generated from it. So, that's one of the hardest things for most business owners. What I say most, just remember the new age digital natives, is lead generation. So if we can actually supply the leads to a business, it takes out, it adds twofold. It makes it a lot easier for us to sell it, the information program, and be a lot easier for them to implement it. So there's more to follow on that.
It comes back to what we were saying before, right? Like, I was at the Grand Prix on Saturday and I spoke to a builder from Melbourne and they've lost like millions and millions of dollars in the last few years, given what's happened with the building market, fixed contracts, prices going up. And this guy has got about 8 or 10 different other side businesses that he's got irons in the fire with. And one of them, you know, he put an ad out onto Instagram and he got like 200 inquiries overnight. And he's like, you know, he goes, lucky, I've always got these other irons in the fire. But that is kind of like how entrepreneurship works most of the time, right? Like, instead of the Zuckerberg or the Bill Gates story that we always see, most entrepreneurs are out there trying different things. And then all of a sudden one finally hits. And that comes back to what we were talking about before, about being anti-fragile and not letting one thing or one point of failure bring you under. And the mistake that new entrepreneurs make is they go all in on something, their whole life savings or their whole capital or whatever.
And they get devastated when that one thing doesn't come off. I mean, 90% of the time they fail. That's just a fact. I mean, Adam, how many businesses, except for Eric? Eric's a unicorn.
Except for Eric.
Let's have it. I mean, you've had a couple of you know, swung for the fences and hit it a couple of times. But on a whole, though, I mean, well, we've been mates for 25 odd years now, and you've certainly had a fair crack at a lot of stuff as well. Business don't always work, even when you buy.
The percentages get better as you get older. You sort of tend to win a bit more often. But I'm certainly not talented. I'm just persistent, you know.
Yeah.
That's it. But, I mean, guys, go ahead, James.
I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, you know, having the irons, and there's a couple of different thought patterns on that, Mark. You've got Alex Emoji who says, you know, you can only do one thing and do it well and do it one, you know, just focus on the one thing. That's okay if the fucking thing works. But then you've got Cody Sanchez who always talks about having multiple streams of income. And they're in the same space. They're in the M&A space. And the
But that's the nuance, right? Like I finally fixed my Amazon business after 18 months of being unprofitable and struggling. And what I worked out was that PPC was that big domino and that big bottleneck. And so I went out and tried these PPC agencies that were talking a big game, like Cody Sanchez and Alex Hormozy. But that big game was nuanced to the things that they made work, right? Whereas the guy that's doing my PPC now, you'll never find him anywhere. He doesn't exist anywhere. He's never not on social media. You're not going to see his face anywhere, but he knows what works for my account. And we've got to be careful not to get caught up in what we hear by the Alex or Moses or the Adam Hudsons or the Erics or Jameses. And we've just got to work out what is it that is the bottleneck and the thing that is going to move the needle for what we're working on. Sure, you can listen to some of the stories and whatnot, but at the end of the day, you've got to apply it to your own nuanced, situation. That's the best advice I could give on all that.
I've had multiple income streams for years now, and it's nice having these little fishing holes. Like I get audiobook royalties still after 20 years that I started back then when the iPod first came out in 2004 or whatever it was. And then I've got like Dry Flash, and then I've got the caravan park, and I've got my first mortgage lending. And whenever I need some money, there's always a little rabbit hole somewhere that I can go and pull 10, 20 grand out of. And that's a nice thing to have that diversity. And that's just years of just having being curious and side hustles and implementing. All right, guys. So with that said, that is the end of our first virtual pod. We will get used to this format as time goes by, but we did all right for the first run through, I think. Well done.
I was just a mess. None of my technology was working. I'm doing this on my phone. So, guys, if the quality of my audio is not as good as the other boys, we'll get it fixed as soon as possible.
Yeah. This is my last one in Australia. Next week, I don't know where I'll be for the next one. I think I'm going to be in Cyprus. I'll be in Cyprus I think I'll be in Cyprus. So it'll either be Cyprus or the Netherlands for the next one. So that'll be next week. And
Adam, there's a guy in macro, his name's Hugh Hendry, and he takes all these calls and Zoom meetings from his beautiful home in St. Bart's, which has got the ocean in the background. He comes on with his aviators on. So next week I expect you to come with the beautiful ocean in the background, the aviators, a cocktail.
If I'm in Amsterdam, who knows how I'm going
to
turn up.
I was about to say, shoot one from Amsterdam and just show us, put it from the main street and just show us what the window shopping's like.
Yeah, fun and games.
Just make sure you speak English.
Exactly. All right, guys, thank you for watching. Remember, like, subscribe, comment, let us know what you think of the format, and we'll talk to you guys next week. Bye for now.
Hey there, I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.